On the cusp of the release of his eagerly awaited book, Aleister Crowley, MI6, The Hess Solution, Richard C. McNeff emerges as a captivating author delving into the enigmatic world of the infamous occultist and spy, Aleister Crowley. Scheduled for publication on October 31st, this novel marks McNeff's second foray into exploring the life and mysteries surrounding the enigmatic figure. Born in a leafy suburb of London, Richard C. McNeff's upbringing was imbued with a rich blend of art, culture, and mystique. His life's journey took him across different lands, including Spain and the picturesque island of Ibiza, where he immersed himself in the local culture and art scene, as well as teaching English. This exposure to diverse experiences laid the foundation for McNeff's unique perspectives and storytelling abilities. Interestingly, McNeff's familial ties also played a significant role in shaping his interests and passion. His father, a distinguished actor, and mother, an inspirational poet and artist, connected him to the vibrant world of art, further fueling his creativity and fascination with the realms of imagination. In his latest work, McNeff embarks on an exploration of the multifaceted Aleister Crowley, whose life story is shrouded in mystery and intrigue. From being a spy and writer to a poet and occultist, Crowley's influence stretches across various realms of human endeavor. Richard C. McNeff seeks to unravel the enigma surrounding this enigmatic figure, delving deep into the clandestine world of espionage and occult practices. Moreover, the author delves into the enduring impact of Aleister Crowley's legacy on contemporary culture, particularly on musicians like Jay-Z, Absol, and many more. McNeff's astute analysis sheds light on how Crowley's esoteric ideas continue to shape artistic expression and thought, even in the modern world. As Richard C. McNeff and his readers journey through the pages of Aleister Crowley, MI6, The Hess Solution, they are sure to be captivated by a narrative that transcends time and space, unveiling secrets and offering profound insights into the enduring fascination one of history's most enigmatic figures. Richard, welcome.
Hello.
This feature interview slot is about music, and you've brought something very different to this particular feature interview that I think is quite fascinating. Until I've met you, I'd never heard of Aleister Crowley. And it was interesting. I was talking to my daughter the other day, and I was talking to her about you and Aleister Crowley, and she said, yeah, the occultist. I'm thinking, excuse me, how do you know about that? So people do know of whom he is. How did you first encounter him?
I think it was a combination of two things. My adolescence, I mean, I was about 14 in 1968, and there was this this sort of big hippie thing going on. So, for example, the Beatles put Crowley on the cover of Sgt. Pepper, which sort of gave him a lot of publicity. And also he was called the by International Times, the hippie newspaper that I would actually go on to publish my short story about him. They called him the unsung hero of the hippies. So he was a very important figure in all that countercultural ferment. He seemed to have anticipated everything that people were doing. And the other thing that happened is, coincidentally, I was living in the... Crowley's reputation began with the publication of a book called The Great Beast, which was a biography that came out in about 1951 or two by John Simmons, who was Crowley's literary executor. And I lived in the same street as John Simmons. So I used to... These two things sort of came together, and I used to talk to Simmons about Crowley, and he used to tell me about Crowley, personal reminiscences. He actually didn't like Crowley, as is well known, and was quite criticised as a biographer because of that sort of bias. And he had a lot of Crowley paraphernalia, being the literary executor. So the two things came together and stirred my interest.
How and where or what is your first recollection of music in the McNeff household?
Oh, my first recollection is actually classical music, but which my parents loved, and things like songs of the American Civil War, and Al Boley. So completely different sort of genres than I got into. But of course, when I was about 13, 14, there was all this incredible music happening, the Doors, the Beatles, the Stones, etc. And I just got swept away by it, much to my father's horror, but because he'd come in and for him, it was just noise. You know, he couldn't understand what it was.
Let's start. We're going backwards. So your first choice here is Ab Soul. Tell us why you've chosen him and this particular track, The Law.
Well, there's a long sort of history of Crowley's influence on music and musicians, but I was interested. He had no influence on certain genres. For example, he had no influence on black music, particularly, for example, soul. But suddenly, in the last few years, it seems like people like hip hop and rap people are really interested in him. Jay-Z, Crowley's essential philosophy, it's summed up in two sentences. It's "do what thou wilt" is the whole of the law. "Love is the law, love under will." And Jay-Z brought out, Ab Soul brought out a record in 2016 called "Do What Thou Wilt." And it's actually got a sort of a track on it called "The Law." And I just thought, I was just really interested to find he had a sort of resonance with these musicians. And of course, Jay-Z famously wore a sweatshirt with "Do What Thou Wilt" on it. As we're if you don't mind me just going on a bit, it's worth pointing out that "Do What Thou Wilt" doesn't mean do what you want to do, do anything you like. It actually means find your true self and develop your true self. It's very actually similar to "Thine own self be true." It's that sort of message. Anyway, if you look on streaming sites, you'll find loads of songs called "Do What Thou Wilt" in all sorts of genres, metal, etc. You'll also find songs called using "Love is the Law," among them people like Noel Gallagher and Toya. But in their cases, I think they just like the expression. It's not, they're not trying to spread a message. But Ab Soul definitely is, because his song references various things like Cairo, where Crowley received what's called the Book of the Law, which is his sort of Bible, and the Eye of Horus and things like that. So, and actually there's a thing on the internet of Ab Soul talking about Crowley and Crowley's influence on him. So I found it very interesting that that particular segment of musicians would get into him.
Love, yeah. Love is the law, love is the only law. I'm a, you should do what thou wilt, you should.
Scanning through the mail, fishing for a fee to feed my female ASAP. Nature is a mother and life is a bitch, I am convinced. God coming, she just taking her time. 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 Man, time, baby.
I get the feeling that you only playing hard to get, cause you ain't forget how much I love a challenge. I know we were divided to restore the balance. Hope I still get you wet while you bending over backwards, watching over me in ecstasy, expecting me. Your number is 6 and 50, interestingly. I hope you're still blue with golden ovaries on your tippy toes for me, just how you're supposed to be. They spoke of us in Cairo quite some time ago. How these Adamans adapt to this is incredible. They love to go to sleep, but hate to be awake. Treat the Eye of Horus as if it's just a symbol. Unattainable, they read the wrong rites. They see the signs, but ain't see what the signs are. But luckily, love is the only law. Love is the only law.
I was coming through the mail, fishing for a fee to feed my female ASAP. Yeah,
Nature is a mother, and life is a bitch, I am convinced, yeah. God coming, she's just taking her time. God coming, she's just taking her time. Yeah. God coming, she's just taking her time. God coming, she's just taking her time. Take your time, baby.
I think it's a sort of certain generation, isn't it? Young people that are looking to find meaning in life, and they come across all sorts of things, and they, something has resonance with them. So Aleister Crowley, for example, Do What Thou Wilt, holds meaning for young people that can be inspired or are in need of some guidance, as it were.
Yes, I think so. And as I say, it's not a bad message, really. It's not an invitation to total license. It's actually an invitation to sort of develop your true self and your will. And it's resonated throughout. I mean, even with punk, for example, there was a band called Eddie and the Hot Rods who brought out a record in 1977 called Do What You Want to Do. And so even in punk, it was quite a strong presence, as it was with hippiedom, as it seems to be in rap and hip hop.
So before we go on to the next track, give us some insight into your younger years growing up. You're an only child. Yeah. So were you spoiled?
Yeah, I think I lived in a sort of cocoon. Yeah, I was a bit spoiled, and I've got some regrettable traits maybe that come from being an only child. I mean, I'm a bit wrapped up in my own world. I had quite an extraordinary upbringing, as my dad was an actor and my mum was an artist, that they prioritised art above everything. They weren't interested in mortgages or things like that. They were very interested in artistic things, and they sort of pushed me along that way. So I think I was quite wrapped up in my imagination. My mum had extremely strong imagination as well from a very early age.
But that's only a good thing, because it allowed your imagination to thrive.
Yes, but it made me a little bit unworldly, shall we say. I'm not. Don't ask me to have any help with DIY or something like that, you know.
As I said in the intro, your father was a distinguished actor. Tell us some more about him.
Well, he started out in repertory theatre after the war. He was actually in the Eighth Army, came back, met my mum. He started doing a teacher training course. He came from a very deprived background, actually, and hadn't had many opportunities. Left school at 14, and he started doing a teacher training course because they opened a lot of doors after the war. But he found he wasn't cut out to be a teacher, and he made a very brave decision to become an actor. So he started out in repertory theatres. And so I spent my childhood all over the country, including in Scotland, just moving from one theatre to the next. It was sort of gypsy or nomadic childhood. I went to about 13 primary schools, and we didn't really settle until I was about 11 in West Hampstead. And just talking about him, he then went on he was in films, he was always playing policemen. So he was like the chief peeler in Oliver, and he worked with Peter Sellers and Terry Thomas, etc. Then he got into television, and he was like in Some Mothers Do Have 'Em, Up Pompeii, things like that. But his most famous role was leading the resistance against the Daleks in the first Dalek invasion of the Earth, where he was actually exterminated. And then I went to school. I was about 11, and everyone commiserated with me, you know. Another time, he was in emergency ward 10 having brain surgery, and he had about 6 children, and that was very confusing for me as well.
But you didn't pursue the acting?
No, I always felt a bit self-conscious when it came to acting. And also, I saw from my dad, and I've known lots of actors in my life, including some very famous ones, without wishing to name drop, but it's like there's a perennial insecurity about it. An actor needs somebody to give them a job. A writer can write, you know, whether people read it or not.
So on to your second choice. This is Night of the Vampire, Joe Meek. What's the relationship here with Crowley?
Well, I was quite surprised how far Crowley's influence goes back. There's even a predecessor to Joe Meek, who's a guy called Harry E. Smith, who did the Anthology of American Folk Music, which Bob Dylan and Joan Baez took a lot of songs from, who was a sort of filmmaker and a beat and an eccentric. That came out in 1952. And he was a bishop in Crowley's church. The influence goes quite a long way back. Joe Meek was like Britain's answer to Phil Spector. There's been lots of publicity about him. There was a film a couple of years back called Telstar, because that's his most famous track, and Margaret Thatcher's favourite track as well. He used to produce records in a flat in Holloway Road. He was very eccentric. He lived on a diet of barbiturates and amphetamines and was famous for pointing guns at people, including Tom Jones and Mitch Mitchell, Jimi Hendrix's drummer, when to make them play properly. He was very interested in the occult. He used to sort of do recordings in graveyards and things like that. And he ended up, and he was interested in Crowley, very interested in Crowley. I think a very strange and difficult man. He ended up actually killing his landlady, shooting her because she was complaining about the noise. And then he shot himself. Recorded Telstar, of course, which is very famous, but he did this other thing with a band called the Moon Trekkers, called Night of the Vampire. There's got certain sound effects. The screams are him when people hear it. And they were originally called the Raiders, came from Hornsey and came to see him. And he didn't like their singer, who was a 16-year-old singer, and he said, "You have to get rid of your singer." That singer was Rod Stewart. He also told Brian Epstein that he was nuts if he took on the Beatles. So maybe his judgment was a little bit warped, but he was a really extraordinary sort of ahead of his time record producer. And so this Night of the Vampire rather reflects the sort of, if you like, the darker side of his interests.
Do you recall any of these tracks, or most of these tracks from your early years, other than just doing the research for the book and also for today's show?
I think all the other tracks we're going to hear, yes, but not this particular one. This was quite new to me. It got to number 50 in the charts, and it was banned by the BBC because they said it wouldn't be suitable for people of a nervous disposition because of all the sort of creaking of coffins and screams and all that. So it was a bit of a new discovery. Of course, everyone must have heard Telstar, which was a global hit.
I'm kind of intrigued to know, because you have a fascination with Aleister Crowley, whether your parents, your father in particular, because they might have been of that certain similar generation to Crowley, whether they had any interest in him.
No, they weren't interested in him or the occult. My mother had quite a magical perception of the world. She was a sort of pantheist, and she was quite a visionary. But that was a purely sort of personal thing. She wasn't allied to any particular ideas. So they were quite tolerant of this sort of when I sort of went hippie, for want of a better word, in my teens. They were pretty tolerant about it. In a way, they were sort of very clean living bohemians. They prided health. My mother made her own bread, her own yogurt. They were in years before that sort of thing became fashionable.
What does becoming hippie mean to you?
Well, it was sort of immersing I saw a thing once on a wall, actually in Amsterdam, and it said to live the life of your to have the time of your life, live the life of your times. And it meant immersing myself in, I mean, suddenly in London at that time in the late 60s, everything seemed to get magical. People were wafting around in robes and growing their hair and wearing caftans and cowbells, and there was all this incredible music. There was this sudden proliferation of colour and love, for want of a better word. Of course, it all went a bit wrong, but it was.
You meant it went a bit wrong?
Well, you know, famously there was the Altamont thing where someone got killed. It all turned a bit sour in 1969. You had the Manson murders. The whole hippie thing started seeming very, a bit too extreme. People took it too far. And there were a lot of casualties. A lot of people's lives were destroyed. I'm not saying there was, you know, by getting into hard drugs and things like that.
It's not a London I'm familiar with. So I was interested to ask the question because you're also enlightening me. So one of the things that Crowley devised was the church. Is it Thelema?
Thelema.
Thelema.
Yeah, Thelema means will in Greek. So then that's the name of his church, if you like, or his organization.
So a bit like L. Ron
Sorry,
Hubbard.
His religion.
His religion.
His religion.
So a bit like L. Ron Hubbard, but Thelema didn't take off.
Well, of course, L. Ron Hubbard was L. Ron Hubbard referred to Crowley as my very good friend, even though they never met. And L. Ron Hubbard was mixed up with a person called Jack Parsons, who was a rocket scientist. And they used to carry out Crowley rituals. So there are some, there is a sort of interesting connection there, though Hubbard claimed he was working for the American Naval Intelligence and was there to expose all these black magicians. So that's all I'm going to say about that. But that's something I touch on in my book, because Jack Parsons is actually in the book. Very interesting character. Yeah, but so you've got Thelema, you've got what's called the OTO, which is the Ordo Templi Orientis, which is Crowley's order in America. And you've got a sort of church called the Ecclesia
Catholica.
Catholica, thank you. And I think there are branches of Crowley's church throughout America and around the world. So that, you know, there is an ongoing thing, but it's nothing like Scientology. It has not, you know, Scientology has you know, millions of followers. Crowley's organization, I think, is a few thousand.
Did you ever dabble in Thelema?
No, yeah, a little bit. When I was younger, I used to do things like the salute to the sun and, you know, where you salute the sun every morning.
Which that's what we call yoga.
Yeah, I know. It's about, well, Crowley was a, well, don't forget, Crowley was extraordinary in that he was one of the first sort of Western practitioners of yoga, seriously. I mean, and one of the interesting things is how he combined Eastern and Western sort of traditions. But I sort of perhaps dabbled a little bit in ceremonial magic, but I didn't take it very far. Even Crowley himself says you don't really need all that sort of stuff, all the paraphernalia and everything. I mean, a lot of it is to do with mental processes, and, you know, I mean, for Crowley, magic was all around us. It was something you did every day in everything you did.
Track 3, Love is the Law, Graham Bond.
Well, unfortunately, people like Joe Meek and Graham Bond, they sort of give this sort of, they emphasize the darkness of this, which is a bit of a shame. Graham Bond was a brilliant multi-instrumentalist. He was in R&B in the 60s. He played the organ and the saxophone. He was quite influential. He introduced the mellotron, which is actually a lovely instrument, which was used by a lot of psychedelic bands. And he was the first person to start introducing classical music into rock. He did a thing called Wade on the Water, which was Bach. But he was born in Essex. He was what's called a Barnardo's boy. He was an orphan, born into an orphanage. And he got fascinated by Crowley in his teens. And because Crowley had an illegitimate son in Essex, he decided that he was Crowley's son. So he started thinking of Crowley as his dad. And anyway, he had a band, quite an influential band with Ginger Baker and Jack Bruce, but they went off to form Cream. And he got more and more into Thelema and magic. And he made a track called Love is the Law, where he's literally using it in the Crowleyan sense, saying things like every man and woman is a star, another sort of quite well-known Crowley saying.
You like the sun, your rays heal my troubled mind. A soulmate in this wounded world is all I try to find. You like the sun, you like the sun, you like the sun, pretty baby, heal my mind. Make me one, make me one. You like the sun, you like the moon, cast moonbeams on my dream, reflecting silent shadows which aren't quite what they seem. You like the moon, you like the moon, you like the moon, pretty baby, heal my mind. Play my life, call my tune. You like the moon. Like a star, like a pinpoint burning bright, live the law of love, together walk in the light. Love is the law, love is the law, Love is the law. Yes, of the star and the moon and the sun. Whoa, in the night. Every man and every woman is a star, way up in the sky. And if we all can but love each other, I tell you our souls will never die. Let's walk in light together.
Sadly, things went wrong for him. He had drug problems, financial problems, relationship problems, and he jumped under a tube train in Finsbury Park Station in 1971. So his story and Joe Meek's story, you can't point the finger, I think, at Crowley, but they're quite tragic stories. But I personally, I find this bit of music very invigorating almost, because he allies the thing with the sun, the moon, the stars. There's a great feeling of nature and a lot of passion in the way he sings it.
Prior to recording this, you also mentioned the relationship that Jimmy Page has. Can you expand on that for me?
Probably of all the musicians who've been influenced by Crowley, Jimmy Page is the best known. There's no real sort of song that shows that. Just to talk about that, he actually played for Joe Meek, because of course before Led Zeppelin, Jimmy Page was a very well-known session musician. And he played in a great sort of band for musicians called John Mayall's Blues Incorporated. Sorry, not John Mayall, Alexis Corner's Blues Incorporated, which also Graham Bond played in, and Charlie Watts, etc. And he got fascinated by Crowley. So to the extent he bought a bookshop in London in Kensington called the Equinox. I used to go there. It was a great bookshop, a magical bookshop, and selling occult books. And he bought Crowley's old house on the shores of Loch Ness called Boleskine House. And they filmed the Led Zeppelin film there, The Song Remains the Same. So Led Zeppelin was, Jimmy Page was very, very interested in Crowley. He put Do What Thou Wilt. It was inscribed on the vinyl of Led Zeppelin 3. Specific music he made a soundtrack for another Crowley enthusiast called Kenneth Anger for a film he made called Lucifer Rising, but they unfortunately fell out and Kenneth Anger cursed him, and there seems to be a lot of curses going around. Apparently when Eddie and the Hot Rods brought out Do What You Want to Do in 1977, they had a picture of Crowley on it with Mickey Mouse ears. So, of course, Jimmy Page cursed them, allegedly, and apparently everything went wrong for them after that. And the other sort of notable incident like that was when Jimmy Page, visited David Bowie in New York in 1975, and he thought Bowie thought Page was playing mind games with him, and Bowie was into Crowley at the time as well, as we'll be going on to talk about. Bowie told Page to leave by the window or the door. He was either being impolite about the window, I think they're on about the second floor, or he thought Page had really developed magical powers. But so that was a famous meeting. So Page was interested in Crowley and the sort of, as he expresses it, I mean, you can see him on YouTube, in this sort of intersection of Eastern and Western thought.
So one of the things that keeps going through my mind, I haven't read your book yet, but I will, is with all the influence of the occult, mysticism and so forth, particularly in the 60s, the hippie movement and so forth, how much of this do you think, particularly Crowley's writings, his setting up of the Thelema Church, was in response to the world wars that the UK had been through at the time, if at all?
Well, Crowley, that's a good question, because Crowley believed that the essence of his philosophy, he believed in a new age, what he called the Aeon of Horus, that we were moving out of the sort of Christian epoch. And he believed that the Second World War particularly was instrumental in bringing that about. Interestingly, he identified the when the New Age would really kick in as about 1965. Crowley died in 1947. And 1965 is actually called Year Zero in terms of music, because you had this incredible leap forward with musicians like the Beatles and the Stones. It all began about 1965, but that may, of course, just be coincidence. So the war played a big part in his theories. And some of the Book of the Law, which came out in 1904, there are some passages that sort of seem, I wouldn't go as far as say predict, but to sort of anticipate some of the things that happened in the Second World War. He talked about war engines that some people think was actually nuclear weapons and things like that. But of course, we all have imaginations.
You mentioned David Bowie. That's the next track, Quicksand.
Okay, well, Quicksand's a very interesting track. Bowie got really, really obsessed with Crowley, I think it's fair to say, in the 60s. And there's, he even sort of, quite a lot of what he did, like, for example, all the persona he adopted, like the Thin White Duke, Ziggy Stardust. Crowley had thousands of, well, not thousands, but scores of persona. Crowley styled himself as Lord Boleskine. He called himself he was into adopting different personalities. Some of Bowie's sort of the mime movements and all that are directly influenced by Crowley. And of course, in the track we're going to hear, which came out in, I think, 1971 on Hunky Dory, Quicksand, he talks about immersed in Crowley's uniform, drawn unto the golden dawn, which was this sort of magical Victorian magic or Edwardian Victorian magical society that Crowley belonged to, and immersed in Crowley's uniform of imagery.
I'm closer to the golden dawn, immersed in Crowley's uniform of imagery. I'm living in a silent film, portraying Himmler's sacred realm of dream reality. I'm frightened by the total goal, drawing to the ragged hole, and I ain't got the power anymore. No, I ain't got the power anymore. I'm the twisted name on Garbo's eyes, living proof of Churchill's lies. I'm destiny. I'm torn between the light and dark, where others see their target, divine symmetry. Yet
just a mortal with potential of a Superman. I'm living on. I'm tethered to the logic of Homo sapiens. Can't take my eyes from the great salvation of bullshit faith.
The thing about Quicksand, of course, is that it's double-edged. It's I'm drawn between the light and dark. He's not Crowley's Bowie's attitude to Crowley is very nuanced throughout his life. He wasn't really sure if it was a good influence or not. He even later on regretted what he called the black magic Kabbalism and Crowleyism of the times. That is the mid 70s. But at this time on Hunky Dory, and again on Station to Station, where he actually references a book by Crowley and references the Kabbalah, Bowie was quite immersed in it. And it did come back, if I may say so, with even on Black Star, his last record, the guy who made the videos was actually a Crowley enthusiast. And there are references on Black Star to possibly to Crowley rituals, as some people even claim that Let's Dance, you know, the great Bowie hit, was actually based on a poem that Crowley wrote. But that's a matter for discussion.
One of the things that I'm interested to hear is the story about Ozzy Osbourne, because I did an interview with Gary Bushell, who had fantastic stories to tell about Ozzy. But this is a different insight into Ozzy Osbourne.
Well, of course, it's worth pointing out that, I mean, Crowley's often, it's standard to refer to him as a Satanist. He probably did flirt with dark forces in what he was doing, but he wasn't a cut and dried Satanist at all. But he's become a sort of byword for Satanism. So, and obviously that sort of is an influence on metal. And so there's been lots of influence, Crowley influence, on heavy metal and other forms of metal, notably Iron Maiden had a track, Crowley track, called Moonchild, a Crowley influence track. And Bruce Dickinson made a film about Crowley in 2008 called Chemical Wedding, with Simon Callow playing a Cambridge professor who was possessed by the spirit of Crowley. But getting on to Ozzy Osbourne, Osbourne was very interested in Crowley, as were Black Sabbath. So he made this track, he made it on his solo album, I think in 1980 or 81, called Mr. Crowley. And apparently he described Crowley as a phenomenon of his time. And there was some Crowley, he read about Crowley, and there's some Crowley tarot cards in the studio. So he and a couple of the musicians he was working with wrote the song, which is quite an intriguing song. The lyrics are very intriguing. He brilliantly manages to rhyme pure with rapport, which is very impressive in my book. He says, did you think you were pure to Crowley? Which is an interesting thing, because Crowley actually had this Gnostic belief that you could immerse yourself in all sorts of terrible things, but somehow emerge pure, which is quite a strange sort of belief. And obviously, Ozzy Osbourne's aware of that. And he's got lovely lines like, won't you ride my white horse? It's symbolic, of course. So Osbourne's song shows quite a deep understanding of Crowley and his system, and it's quite impressive in its own right.
Mr. Crowley, what went on in your head? Pulled all the painful and
I mean, Crowley himself believed that he got into magic because of death. You know, he thought, what's this death? We stop existing, nothing. And he thought there must be more. So death, he said, put him in a blue funk. So he got into magic and maybe extreme forms of sexuality as well as a way of sort of defying death, of trying to find out if there was something beyond that. So, and I think people are probably scared of that sort of experimentation.
We haven't touched on him being a spy.
Crowley was born in about 1875. He came from his very fundamental Plymouth Brethren family, which he reacted against. He was very wealthy as a young man. He may well have been recruited as early as when he was at Cambridge University. He certainly was involved, and it's more and more documented with British intelligence throughout his life, various branches. There's quite a lot of documentary evidence. For example, in the First World War, he went to America. He became a pro-German agitator, and he was writing for these papers saying, let's hope the Germans win, and let's hope the Kaiser lives forever. And he even gave the address of his aunt. He didn't like an aunt in Basingstoke, and he gave her address so that the German Zeppelins would bomb her and things like that. And he was an agitator. He burnt his British passport. He came back to England in 1919. Absolutely nothing happened to him. He wasn't arrested or anything. So there's a lot of evidence he was working for the Secret Service then. And it goes on. He had a very, very interesting connection. Someone who features quite heavily in my book, a man called Maxwell Knight, who was called M, who ran a secret division of MI5 and was actually studied under Crowley with the horror story writer Dennis Wheatley. There's all these sort of strong links between Crowley and the Secret Service. Then that's MI5, MI6, Naval Intelligence and Special Branch at Scotland Yard. There's evidence that he worked as a sort of maverick for all of them.
And to come back and nothing happens to him. He was protected.
Yeah. And also, if you think about it, what a marvellous cover, this sort of occult, notorious diabolist who's actually a spy, you know. And so that there's quite strong evidence. And it goes on and on. Even when he died, he had a child with a much younger woman who was actually connected with British intelligence. Her husband was in British intelligence. He had lots of connections with British intelligence. But he was a multifaceted man. He was an occult polymath. He was incredibly erudite. He was a mountaineer. He was a chess player. He was a painter. He was a poet. He was a writer. And he was arguably the most important practitioner of the occult of the 20th century. I mean, there's sides to him that don't, you know, that for the squeamish are not very attractive, maybe. I mean, I'm not here to promote him as such, but I think he's a very interesting character for investigation, and his influence is quite extraordinary. I mean, we're looking at music, but as you said, there's other areas where he's had quite a strong influence on people.
Well, another thing that you drew my attention to was Damon Albarn's opera.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. Damon Albarn did an opera called Dr. D in 2014. John Dee was the court magician of Elizabeth I, and he devised he was a magician. He was the original 007 because that was his actual, that's how, because of course Ian Fleming knew Crowley and all the rest of it, which is in my book, but he was the 007 because of the pince-nez that was like 007 because she called John Dee her eyes. Anyway, he evolved a language called Enochian, which was designed to, which they called the language of the angels, to actually talk to angels, which Crowley practiced as well. And on Damon Albarn's opera, Crowley made recordings of him reciting Enochian, this strange angelic language. And on a track called Edward Kelly, Damon Albarn actually has an excerpt from Crowley reciting this strange angelic language.
Well, we've got to get on to your final choice here. Blood, Sugar, Sex, Magic, the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Apparently, this is because their connection is because of the guitarist, John Frusciante, who apparently is very, or was or is, I wouldn't know, but very interested in Crowley and had sort of Crowley-esque songs on his solo albums. So this was actually a very important album for them. It was a sort of breakthrough album, I think, in the early 90s. And the particular track, Sex Magic, of course, Crowley spelt his magic with a K to distinguish it from sort of conjuring or common or garden magic. And they spelled this with a K. And Sex Magic was part of Crowley's system where you use the sort of energy or excitement of sex to actually focus on achieving, if you like, non-sexual results. So you would focus on a particular objective during the act of sex. And that's, and of course, there's more to it than that. It's connected with Tantra and things like that. And this is this track sort of seems to be going into that territory. This is a slightly unusual interview to surrounding music. I normally ask my guests, you know, if they want to go back to a particular period in their life, what would they say to their younger self? Do you have a particular point in your early life, your childhood, where you felt that you might have been struggling for whatever reason and would like to go back and reassure your younger self? What would you say? I would go back. Actually, I had a very difficult period in around about 1994, and actually, I was living on Ibiza. But living on Ibiza was quite a wonderful place to live, but it was quite extreme. There were no limits in some ways, and I went through a period where I became a bit of a sort of casualty of that, and I would go back to myself. And say that, you know, it would work out. And thankfully it has.